initially you would have to say, no, I can't ride a bike because you never have ridden one. But the minute you get on the bike and you fall off a couple of times and you get back on it, and then you realize you suddenly can ride one. And then once you've done that, you know, you get a little bit more ambitious and so on.
Hello and welcome to episode 32 of Attention Engineer. Kid, a music producer, songwriter, and solo artist making music as Penfriend, and beaming into your ears from my studio, The Launchpad, in Bristol. You can find me around the internet at Penfriend Rocks. Come and say hi. Thanks for joining me today as I continue my mission to encourage creativity in every listener by sharing conversations with some of the artists I admire the most. It's been a hell of a week since I last spoke to you. A few weeks of going to bed way too late, heaping stress onto myself without a break, and some weird idea that introducing a shitload of sugar into my diet would give me energy, all combined to bring me to my knees. And I spent a couple of days wrapped up in my duvet with my feelings while, of course, peeking out to edit podcast interviews. Lockdown 3 has felt harder and harder, and heading into the 13th month of not seeing a single family member is a pretty sorry anniversary. Sometimes I want to ignore what's going on in the world in these intros because I feel like these episodes could be a source of entertainment and escape for you. But also, I am finding this hard, and this podcast is quite a lot about feelings, so pretending I'm fine would be weird, but I also don't want to be a massive downer. So, just know that I am struggling through like everybody else. Some days I feel hopeful, and some days I do not, and recently it's been a bit bleak. It's worth noting, though, that 4 days ago I could barely bring myself to drink a glass of water to make myself feel better, and last night I was able to set myself up for a brighter week by setting my alarm for 7:30 a.m. and pushing it away from the bed. There's a life hack for you. I get into really bad snooze habits, which makes me give up on morning exercise and immediately feel rubbish. So today I got fully out of bed at 7:30, willed myself not to dive back under the lovely warm duvet, and went out for a run. I didn't go far, I didn't go fast, but I went, and I listened to music, Howling Bell's first album, and I've been feeling practically jolly all morning. Let that be a lesson to future me. There's always something I can do to give myself a better chance of feeling okay. Speaking of self-motivation, today's guest is someone I've wanted to speak to for a while. Mike Batt is an English singer-songwriter, musician, arranger, record producer, director, conductor, and former deputy chairman of the British phonographic industry. Having achieved substantial international success as a solo artist, he's particularly known in the UK for creating the Wombles pop act, writing many hits including the chart-topping Bright Eyes, and discovering Katie Melua. The man behind pop hits for Cliff Richard, David Essex and Alvin Stardust, collaborations with XTC, Vanessa May and the London Philharmonic Orchestra, and the conception and co-creation of all-female string quartet Bond, Mike set up his Dramatico record label in 2002. Working with Carla Bruni, Marianne Faithfull, Caro Emerald, Gurumul and Sarah Blasco, he released Katie Melua's first 6 albums and wrote, co-wrote and produced the first 3. He has also conducted many of the world's great orchestras, including the London Symphony, Royal Philharmonic, London Philharmonic, Sydney Symphony, and Stuttgart Philharmonic in both classical and pop recordings and performances. I was really keen to invite Mike onto the show because he did all of that as a completely self-taught songwriter, musician, and orchestrator. I subscribe to the idea that we're all making it up as we go along, but quite often people pretend they're not, so I was excited to dig into that aspect of Mike's career. Also, he followed me on Twitter years ago, which always pleased and slightly baffled me, so this was a lovely excuse to say a proper hello. Here we go. So just before we get into our conversation, could you please introduce yourself for my listeners?
Hi, Laura. Yes, it's Mike Batt. And in case anyone doesn't know who I am, I'm a songwriter, singer, producer, conductor, arranger, blah-de-blah. Quite a lot of things, actually. Too many things.
I was wondering about that because I have that written down. So I've got artist, songwriter, arranger, record producer, director, conductor, film score writer. Have I missed anything out?
Ah, so you knew already.
Well, I like to—I do like to prepare myself. I knew many of those things that you'd done, but it's interesting to read about people before I talk to them because then I find out all the other things I didn't know.
Yeah, but I suppose if I asked about you, if there's anything else, you could probably say, oh, you know, I'm good at painting roofs or something.
Yeah. Well, so what have we missed out? What else are you good at?
Well, I like cooking. I'm useless at putting up shelves.
Okay.
I'm okay at tearing them down.
Oh, that's fun as well.
Yeah. What else? I love drawing, painting, and I do a lot of work. Anyone who wants to check my stuff out on my website, it's mikebatt.com. And there's a piece on doodles and drawings and things like that. And I've done that all my life. I've been interested in animation, so that's a complementary thing to my music because animation and music go well together.
Definitely.
You know, sometimes I've done music for animation, other people's animation, and sometimes I've done little bits of animation for my own projects, and it kind of fits quite well.
Yeah. Well, that's a really interesting way to start a conversation, really, because this podcast is about creativity in general. So I'm talking to people about their creative careers, but I don't think that your creativity starts and ends with the thing you do for work. Even if the thing you do for work is something that other people might be like, wow, what a creative career. That's amazing.
Well, I suppose most people are creative. Some people just haven't discovered that they are, you know.
Yeah.
Like I know, for example, my dad, who was an engineer, and you'd think, okay, he's a scientist. He was in the army. He was a Royal Engineer. And then he came to civil engineering. But he could pump out three great tunes on the piano, just three. I mean, someone had taught, and he just used the black keys. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't chopsticks. It was proper pub piano playing. I thought it was amazing. How can that otherwise scientific, you know, mechanical, I thought he was a genius. You could build a car if you wanted to. And so I think the brain is quite, well, you know, we all know that it's a very amazing organ. But I don't think you are just one or the other. And I think my dad, had he not been such a good mechanic and such a good engineer, he could well have easily, you know, sort of fallen into doing music and might become a good musician, you know. So, and I think we're all capable of all sorts of different things. We just don't know. We haven't got time on earth long enough to discover, probably.
We can try, though, can't we? Because you're really packing it in with all your different escapades.
We could try, yes. Escapade's a great word, isn't it?
Yeah. Do you feel that you're on a mission to try as many things as possible? Is that why you do so many things?
No, and I almost wish I didn't try so many things because it can hold you back.
Okay.
If, for example, you've got a musical you've written and you are you have a powerful idea of how you want it to be designed and played out, so you want to direct it yourself, then that's a turnoff for a lot of people because you can't go to a director with it for a start at a theatre company because they'll think, well, I can't direct it then if he wants to direct it.
Yeah.
So it doesn't get on. That doesn't get put on. Personally, I like the fact that I do so many things because I have managed to put on some productions where I've had quite a lot of input. But I'd never just insist on doing something because I can. I mean, I would never choreograph a TV show that I was directing because I can't choreograph, can't even dance, never mind choreograph. So I know my limitations, but where I have a sort of dream and say, you know, like I did in 1982, where which was a thing called Zero Zero, which I made for the Australian Broadcasting Commission, the BBC of Australia. And the design concept was essential to the story, at least by the time we got to the studio floor, it was, and it was a checkerboard floor, a checkerboard sky. Everyone wore checkerboard. It was just a checkerboard world. And I won't go any further about the story or it's past or future, but it was either, actually. And I had a lot of fun doing that, and I wouldn't have had that fun or that artistic experience and what's the word, fulfillment, if I hadn't said to the ABC, would you please let me design this show?
Yeah.
And I think because I was from a different country and they sort of, I don't know what impression they had of me, but they presumably thought if I thought I could design it, I must be able to.
Yeah.
And so they said yes, whereas in England, they might have said, oh, no, we've got to use a BBC designer for this one.
Right.
So, you know, it's good. It was good to be allowed that freedom.
Mm. And I've read that you talked about how you taught yourself how to orchestrate and arrange music.
Yeah.
Which I love because I have also done that, or I'm in the process of doing that, always in the process of doing that. I think a lot of people might just presume that someone with such a wide-ranging and long-lasting music career is like really well trained, went to all the schools, you know, did it in a very formalized way.
Hmm.
But I love reading about your career because it just sounds like you, and I don't use the, I don't want to use the word blag because that sounds like you're making a, you know, a blag as someone who can't necessarily follow it up with something.
Yeah.
I think that reaching further than what you're already able to do and then being able to do it is quite a different thing. So how do you look at that?
Yeah, well, I've done that all my life. I mean, always with the preface, of course, that we are all bluffing our way through life, aren't we?
Yes.
A little bit. That imposter syndrome thing never kicked in with me.
Wow.
And I never thought, oh, I'm not worthy of doing this. I've always thought, well, yeah, I mean, as I say, with choreography, I would, if I was stupid enough to wake up one day having convinced myself in a dream that I could choreograph a production, I'd go in and make a complete idiot of myself in the rehearsal room. But where you feel that you can do something, one example I think is that I very much wanted to orchestrate and I hadn't been to music college, as you say, and I'd nevertheless, you know, studied through looking at books and reading how Rimsky-Korsakov orchestrated and how Glenn Miller orchestrated. Mm-hmm. And teaching myself, somebody said to me, the manager of a big group that was about to be massive, do you do string arrangements? And I said yes, when I hadn't ever done one.
Yeah.
And that allowed me to do one, because he said, well, you've got a 25 piece orchestra booked in 10 days time, can you do the charts for this album? And it was very scary because this was the band that the Beatles thought were going to be the next Beatles.
Wow.
They're called Family. And they were big. They did become big. And their first album, it was called Music in a Doll's House, was the one I did. It was my very first job as an arranger when I was 18. And it was eventful, to say the least. I mean, I forgot to transpose all the B-flat instruments in the brass section.
Right.
So it's just sounded horrendous. And until the boys realised that although I was a bluffer, I was only as much a bluffer as anyone else in the world, and they were going to help me out. And they transposed it at sight so that the guys in the control room didn't think I was, hadn't made a, you know, that they didn't suss me, put it that way.
Right. That's brilliant. That's really kind, because they could have really screwed you over then.
They could have. In fact, there's a very famous, he's died now, but there was a very famous tenor sax player called Tubby Hayes, a genius guy, you know, up there in the sort of Wynton Marsalis ranks as a sax player, although he's a trumpet player, but, you know, and he just was doing a session job and he was the head of the sax section. And it was he who said to me, don't worry, mate, we'll sort it for you.
That's really kind.
I didn't know him, but I never got to know him, but I've always been mentally sort of secretly grateful for that moment.
Well, I think there's lots of moments in our lives where we've got the opportunity to be kind or not be kind. And it's nice that he decided to do you a favour, really.
Yeah, because there are many times when you're in that situation, and I had it myself, you know, particularly more when I was younger and less experienced. You've got a great big orchestra. Could be the Sydney Symphony Orchestra. It could be the London Symphony Orchestra. Actually, the LSO were always very kind and generous to me. But I've had one or two players in one or two orchestras where, and there are one or two moments I can remember, but I'm not going to go into great detail, where you suddenly realise the whole orchestra's against you, you know, and you're 23 years old. And it might be because you're only 23 years old, whatever. And any orchestra player And any conductor will tell you that that does happen. They suddenly smell the fear or whatever it might be. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
And go for your throat. And it's usually all lead trumpeters listening to this, please close your ears. Very often it's the lead trumpet player.
Really?
Yeah. I had a bit of trouble with the lead trumpet player of an orchestra in Australia. It wasn't the Sydney Symphony. It was it's in Melbourne. And he gave me hell. It was almost like, who the hell do you think you are coming here thinking you can conduct us?
Right.
And I had made a couple of mistakes. Not using a score, for example, for a massive, I think it was the Planets we were doing, Planets.
Yeah.
I thought, well, if Claudio Abbado can not use a score, why can't I? But of course, most conductors do use a score because the real, it's like going on a long road trip without having a map.
Yeah.
And so, of course, it's sensible to use a score, but I was trying not to. And this trumpet player went for my throat. And right, in a way, rightly, but it's the way they did it. Mm-hmm. And it we always had to break the sessions down and re-establish the diplomacy between me and the orchestra before we could carry on. And then we carried on and we did a very successful concert.
So interesting. I first got stitched up by an orchestra when I was 7 because I had joined the local, it was in Darlington. I was living in the Northeast as a child, and I was playing violin, and I'd only just started, and I played it all the way through school. And I started going to this, I guess it was the county orchestra for kids, you know, on a Saturday morning. And for some reason, as a sort of, I don't know, a trial by fire or whatever, I was brought up to the front to conduct the orchestra. I was supposed to be taught how it works. And so I started like waving my arms around, and I could read music and you know, at a rudimentary level and whatever. Started waving my arms around and nothing happened. And of course, I hadn't done the thing where you get them all to, what's it called when you sort of gather them all up so they all put the bows in the air? What's that called? Is there a name for that?
Oh, you mean that upstroke, that almost like an upbeat? Almost like a pre-beat ready, and I don't know what it's called.
Oh, okay.
I remember failing. I know you. I want to hear your story, but I remember failing to do that myself at the Royal Albert Hall when the Queen was there.
Oh my God!
And this military band didn't do anything, and I brought my baton down because I hadn't done the preparatory. There you go. That's called a preparatory stroke.
Right, that's it. Well, no one had told me about the preparatory stroke, and I was 7. How was I supposed to know about this?
Yeah.
So I think that they were trying to make it into like a joke, but not at my expense exactly. But it felt very embarrassing. I was very hot in my face, and then I went and sat down and felt sad.
Yeah, if they laughed, if you're conducting and they laughed, that is a joke at your expense.
Yeah, not nice.
And it feels horrible, but that's the sort of baptism of fire that anybody goes through.
Yeah.
So did you go through all of the stages of violin and classical training then?
No. I played at school from 7 till 18. And when I was 15, I wanted to start a band. So I started trying to do that instead. And then I started playing the bass guitar because it was the classic, you know, bassist didn't turn up to the first rehearsal. Who's going to play the bass? Oh, she can. It can't be that difficult sort of thing. And then I started playing bass. And then bass kind of became my job after university. And then, I didn't finish university, but I started university to leave home, essentially, because I wanted to start a band. And then I haven't played strings since then, but I do now arrange strings for my own music.
Right.
And I'm trying to get into doing stuff for others as well, in that kind of slightly blaggy, but I do kind of know what I'm talking about. Like, I can make it sound good, but I don't know what I'm doing necessarily.
Well, it sounds just like me. Really?
Yeah. So that's why I'm so inspired by your story, because you've done so much amazing stuff. And I think that just is it's brilliant proof for anyone who wants to be creative that, like I say, it's kind of, for me, it's about reaching slightly further than is comfortable, but then quickly being able to do it. Because if you'd said, yes, sure, I'll orchestrate that thing for you, and then what you gave them was rubbish, it's game over at that point in terms of that relationship. So you have to deliver, don't you?
Yeah, and you have to. You can relate it to other things, much more easy things for people who aren't musicians to understand, like riding a bike.
Right.
Initially, you would have to say, no, I can't ride a bike because you never have ridden one.
Yeah.
But then when you get on the bike and you fall off a couple of times and you get back on it, and then you realise you suddenly can ride one.
Mm.
And then once you've done that, you know, you get a little bit more ambitious and so on.
Yeah, then it's just repetition then. It's just surely album after album at that point, isn't it? for you.
Well, one would hope that isn't repetition in that sense. No, not no. like churning them out. But because again, you see, that comes right back to your thing about doing lots of different things. I like to think that if I do something new, it would be my next project would be original, not exactly like my last project.
Yeah, of course. In terms of client work versus self-generated projects, what's been the balance of that over your career so far?
Probably two-thirds self-generated and a third hired. For example, when I first started out, well, this is an exact 50-50 situation. Somebody hired me to my great delight at a young age, to arrange 6 albums of 12 songs each for an orchestral album series called The Portrait of whatever, Portrait of Bob Dylan, Portrait of Simon and Garfunkel, just instrumentals in the days when instrumental records were, you know, pretty popular. And they were going to pay me so much score.
Mm.
And yet when I'd finished doing all this work for them, they told me that their deal had fallen apart. So they weren't going to pay me, couldn't pay me.
Wow.
And I thought that was bad form, obviously.
Well, it must have taken ages as well.
Yeah, it did. It took me, well, it took less time than you think. I was living on a houseboat and I gave myself, I had to do a minimum of 3 scores per day.
So that's a lot, wow.
Yeah. So and that's writing all the rhythm section, everything out. And so I used, I had an absolute, you know, the diary, I've got it still, says 9 till, I think it was 4 hours. Yeah, it's 4 hours per song. So it's an hour to lay it out just with a pencil before computers were available to do this. An hour to lay out all the chords and the tune of from the sheet music. And add any intro I wanted to, which might be original. Then another hour to fill in the strings, say. Another hour to fill in all the wind. And a fourth hour to go and check it all and make sure. And then that was it finished. So in a 12-hour day, I could do 3 songs. And I literally went in at 9 o'clock and came out at whatever it is, 12 hours later, 9 o'clock, I suppose.
Yeah.
And so I had 100, what was it, 6 times 12, 72 arrangements done. And the guy said, I'm sorry, we can't pay you. And so, but what they did do is they gave me the right. I said, well, you have to give me the rights to this series. You have to fly me to France, to the, what they call MUDEM, which is the Marche Internationale d'Édition Musicale, which is basically a music publishing festival. But lots of records get sold there as well. You've got to put me up in a, because they were going there anyway as a company. Right. It was my own publisher, by the way.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, to preserve our relationship, you have to fly me to France, buy me a ticket to go into MUDEM, put me up in they had their own flat. So I want a bedroom in that flat. And I stitched the deal back together again by selling it to 3 different record companies, one Japanese one, one German one, and one English one. And I came back and then made the series. Looking back on it, it's not the best series of music I've ever made. You know, it was done hurriedly, but it really taught me how to work quickly, because on a budget, I think we had £600 per album from each of the three. So 3, 6, 8, £1,800 per album with a 27-piece orchestra. It meant we had to record 6 songs in every 3-hour session.
Wow.
Which meant making each album from 10 a.m. till 1 a.m., or 1 p.m., and from 2 p.m. till 5 p.m. on the same day. 2 sessions, that's 6 hours, and the album had to be finished by the end of the day. And that was the only way I could even make it pay, never mind make any profit from it.
Yeah.
But that really taught me how to work quickly. It also taught me how orchestras are quite capable of walking out if you go over by a minute.
Yes, I've heard about that. Yeah.
It's all good fun, though. And you look, looking back on it, it's sometimes horrible, but sometimes great.
Well, you sound like you're someone who's very good at negotiating and advocating for yourself. Because I've read the story, the Wumble story, where they offered you some paltry sum to do a session job and you decided that it might be better if you had the rights to... Is it the rights to the characters being able to make music? Is that what
that's
that
right, yeah. Right. Indeed, yeah.
That is so smart, and you couldn't possibly have known how successful it was going to be.
No, I didn't know how successful it was going to be, but the key to the... whether it was smart or not, is the fact that they didn't know how successful it was going to be either. Yeah. And frankly, without the music band, without the group being a band and going on Top of the Pops, it wouldn't have been as successful.
No, so you really helped it.
And I say that with great respect to the project, because, you know, mm-hmm. the books were great, the TV show was great, but it would have remained as a children's five-year-old thing if it hadn't gone mainstream with the, with the songs. So... yeah, and it wasn't a paltry sum, really. They offered me £200, which I looked it up the other day. I did one of the, I put it through one of those calculators that show what it's worth now, and it was worth something like £4,500 or something.
Oh, of course. Sorry, I wasn't taking that into account at all. I just went, oh, £200 for a, you know, these days. Right.
I'm not saying it was four and a half, but it was definitely a substantial fee, £200. Right, yeah. And I was, I literally needed that money. I mean, we were short of cash, lived on the houseboat still. The mortgage payment would have been due because you can get a mortgage for a houseboat, just in case you didn't know.
Ah, no, I didn't know that.
So it wasn't a great financial moment. I wasn't rich enough to say, oh, I don't need that money, but it just felt like an opportunity. And I just so much loved the characters. Mm. I wanted the artistic fun. I think this has touched on something which maybe your listeners might find interesting, is that if you're driven by the art as much as by the commerce, and I think you have to be driven by both. Yeah, you can't just sit in your room and do paintings or write music and hope no one's ever going to see them or buy them, and you'll just do them and, you know, you'll go and do a different job to make money. You can do that, and that's fine, but it won't. It's not the way to be a professional person doing what you do.
Yeah.
But neither is it right to be cynical and say, oh, I know how to have a hit record. I'll get a pretty girl and a strong song and I'll just put them together and make lots of money. Well, lots of people do that, you know, and it's valid, but it's not as fun and as valid as being absolutely so turned on by the artistic side of it that you get you get really rewarded artistically by the satisfaction, fulfillment, that's the word.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, you've been making music for 50 years, is that right?
Mm.
So if you were now looking back at, you know, your litany of hits, whether they've been bigger or smaller hits than you have actually had, but they meant so much less to you because it was just that pretty girl song, commerce in your brain. That, I mean, for me, that would be not a good life lived, you know. That's not creatively fulfilling and interesting. We all need to be able to live, you know, and make our next thing, of course. And hopefully that music can come from the thing you're making. In my, you know, that's what I'm aiming for in my life.
Yeah.
But it is much more about the impact of the art, isn't it? Like the communication, whatever it is, that the magic of a song.
Yes.
Rather than how much money can I make if I do these notes in this order, you know, or if I can do this project or what have you.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's good to hear that from someone who's done a lot of music.
No, but I've also been in that situation with another writer.
Mm.
I remember I used to write with other people. I'm a bad collaborator in terms of writing. I hope I'm theatrically and in lots of other ways a good collaborator. But writing, I find really difficult with other people because of the diplomacy involved, you know. So if they hate your idea, but it's actually quite a good idea, or more likely it's a bad idea and they love it, you know. And the diplomacy of saying, can you just live with my idea for a minute? And then if we hate it in an hour's time, we'll get rid of it.
Yeah.
All of that discussion, or you're saying you love their idea and them saying, okay, but you're both wrong, you know. That whole thing, I think I've gone off at a tangent about co-writing.
This is all about tangents, though, don't worry.
No, we were talking about the sort of cynical version of that.
Yeah.
And there were times in my, you know, when I was starting out, 19, 20, 21 years old, working with other producers, people who went on to have big hits.
Mm.
One guy who was a friend of mine who went on to write a lot of Billy Ocean's early work. Another guy, Bidu, who was he had an artist, Tina Charles, who did a song called "I Love to Love," but my baby just loves to dance. You probably don't even know it.
Yeah,
anyway, it was a big song, and he also had the Bidu Orchestra. And he was musical, and he had is musical. He's still around, Indian guy, and he was a good friend. And nevertheless, I do remember sometimes sitting with him and thinking, right, what can we write that will be a hit? What's been a hit lately? Oh, I know, Sugar Sugar by the Archies. Let's play that and let's get that exact drum beat and let's put that sort of strumming thing on it and then we'll think of a tune afterwards. And as I've grown older, it didn't take me to get much older than that. I mean, I was writing songs from the heart, if you like, since I was 17. But I've stopped ever doing that thing I used to do with other co-writers when I was younger.
Mm.
And I just write what I want to write, whether it's for another person, like a director of a film or a project that isn't mine. I'm serving someone else. I'm still writing from my heart. And in a way, you have to be a bit like an actor in a situation like that, in that you might be writing for a girl who is got wanderlust, or she's fallen in love with a guy who's not good for her. Whatever it is, you have to project yourself into that person's mind and write on their behalf. You're their sort of advocate. And I find that it's like acting, really.
Mm.
But it's still from your heart because
you're
putting yourself into it.
Yeah. It sounds like a really beautiful thing to do, actually. It's quite a wonderful thing. I mean, I always think of songs as being a way of summing up things that other people can't necessarily sum up, because for the listener, I think people respond so well to songs that say what they would love to say if they knew they wanted to say it, almost, you know?
That's right. Yeah, you've got it in one there, because people often think, oh, wow, that's my life story that she's telling.
Yeah.
And if you've found a witty or interesting or new way to say something that they've often thought, even if it's only "I love you" or "I hate you," you know, they immediately identify with it.
Yeah.
Which is, again, a commercial consideration.
Right.
It's one thing driving the other.
Yeah. Do you mean in the sense that you need, when you're writing a song and you're thinking commercially, or if one was thinking commercially, you're thinking, can people understand this? Would people want to say these same things? Is that what you mean?
Yeah. I mean, all I'm saying is that if people love your work, you're more likely to be commercially successful than if they don't love your work.
Yes.
It's as simple as that, really. You know?
Yeah, it's a very good point. I asked people on Twitter yesterday what I should ask someone I didn't say who I was talking to because I love secrets. But I asked them what I should ask someone with your background. And they asked really brilliant questions that I wouldn't have come up with. So I'd love to ask you a few of those, if that's okay.
Of course.
Specifically about songwriting.
I can't promise the answers will be great, but we'll see how they go.
That's okay. Have you ever written the same song twice?
Not the same actual song, not the same tune.
Mm.
There's always that horror when you've written a song and you think it's good, and you think, wow, you want to play it to all play it to my wife or whatever. I think, I've just got to check in my mind, has this song been written before?
Yeah.
Is it one I've written before? Is it one I wrote 10 years ago? Is it one that Andrew Lloyd Webber wrote? You know, and once you convince yourself that it isn't, because if it is, you've got to throw it away, no question.
Yeah.
Or change 6 notes of it or 2 notes of it, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I've never written the same song twice. The nearest I came was when I was doing jingles, they started asking people to pitch for jingles so that everyone in town was writing for the same commercial. And it was for a lager, Tennent's Lager. And I wrote something. I sent it to my agent, who was the commercial production company, and I then played it to my wife, and she said, you know, you've just rewritten Waltzing Matilda, don't you?
That unknown little ditty.
Yeah. I mean, I'd sat there at the piano for a couple of hours and I'd written this 30-second commercial that was absolutely waltzing Matilda all the way through with different lyrics, of course.
Right.
Tennant's Lager or something, whatever it was.
Waltzing Lager, waltzing
Yeah,
lager.
Tennant's. Something like that, yeah. And, needless to say, I didn't get the job.
Did anyone say, we've heard that one before?
No.
They didn't.
I just didn't hear back. And also something else, which is part of, I know we're going beyond the question now, but something else that's triggered in my mind is that in my life, when I've been asked to pitch for something, I've failed.
Mm.
And whenever they trust me enough to come to me and say, Mike, we want you to write this, I rise to the occasion and I've never been asked to repeat or remake something or rewrite. So I need to know I'm loved, if you like, and trusted in order to be able to get on my charger and go into battle for them.
So would you credit your self-generated projects for giving people that confidence in you and wanting you? Or has that come from previous client work as well?
I think it's just general. Yeah, I mean, Bright Eyes was a client commission.
Oh, okay.
You know, it was, please, will you write a song about death for a film?
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, that's hard. And then after about a couple of days, I thought, well, it's actually the most important thing, what happens after you die. So I wrote that, which is what Bright Eyes is. And so that is a commission. And if I didn't do those commissions, I would perhaps get bogged down in a direction which might, or rather the freshness of that coming at me from when I was doing something else. Mm-hmm. Would have taken me down a different side road to the one I might have gone down had I been concentrating on something else at that time.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. I've just started dipping my toe into commissioned music, and by which I mean I've been trying to get something going on for years.
Yeah.
And only just recently someone invited me to submit some ideas.
Yeah.
And so I spent the other day, just the whole day, working to a brief, and I loved it so much. It was so nice to just have a deadline, have a very specific thing to make. And I made stuff that I definitely wouldn't have made if I was just sort of noodling around making a song for myself or for my project or whatever.
Mm.
And so that's like a door opening in my head to this sort of new possibility of and something I think could feed into my work as well and whatever. So I love that because I think if an artist just did exactly what they wanted all the time, there's nothing wrong with that. It could be wonderful, and I think that's great. But I suppose it just means that these other pathways don't come along, do they? Or these other options of sound.
Exactly, and it gives you a different, fresh thing to think about.
Well, that was a great answer. Well done.
Thank you.
Very good question.
Tick.
For every great song you've written, how many do you discard?
Almost none.
Ooh, that is really interesting.
Yeah. I don't write 100 songs and then pick 10.
Ah.
No, I write one song and I wait until it's right before I issue it. And if it's not right, I don't issue it. Mm-hmm. But so there must be some discarded ones. And I've got a folder full of things throughout my life, bits of paper I've jotted ideas down on, songs I haven't really ever got to the end of.
Mm-hmm.
But I never demo a song and then think, right, that's useless, I'm not going to use it. It wouldn't even get to the demo stage unless I thought it was worth having. So I write quite few songs, really. I don't write more than maybe 10 or 12 songs a year.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be because I have a project on that needed 10 or 12 songs. And these days I never write unless I have a project. In other words, if I've got an artist who wants me to write for them or I'm producing something. Last year I was writing a musical with two authors who had written the script, and I had to write 26 songs in 7 weeks. For that, and that was a great having a deadline is just brilliant, because it was at a time when I was on my own at home. My wife is in Australia, and so I'd get out of bed in the morning, I think, right, I've got to write a song today. I've got to do a demo by this evening. It's got to have full lyrics and a reasonable demo, piano, bass and drums or whatever. And I would time myself throughout the day, and by 3 o'clock, if I hadn't done enough, I'd, you know, push myself on a bit further until I had, by the time of the evening, come to the point where I could go to the piano and sing it into a microphone.
Yeah.
So I don't know what that is the answer to. I can't remember. It's how many songs you write that you don't use. And I never submitted one of those songs of an evening for that musical where we said, oh, no, we won't use that one. It's not up to the standard. You know, I just write. And if it gets past my filter, I hope the filter's good enough for other people to like it too.
Yeah,
I might not always be right, but that's my basic abiding principle.
Yeah. And do you find yourself doing much editing of songs later before they get completely finished? So past that demo stage, would those songs have been worked on more? Or would they only be worked on more because there's a client involved and they might want something tweaked or what have you?
Very little. Very often there might be, oh, do we need a middle eight? Does it need a guitar solo? Old-fashioned thing that is, but nevertheless, do we need one?
Oh, it's still going. People still have a guitar solo.
Because a guitar solo is a songwriter's excuse not to write a middle eight.
Yes.
Isn't it?
I couldn't put it better myself. Or the guitarist going, it's my turn, please.
Yeah.
I want some attention now, please.
Exactly, which is fine too.
Of course, everyone needs a bit of attention, don't they?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm more into guitar hooks than solos personally, although I like really melodic. If it's doing something, I'm into it as a guitar solo. If it's not, then it's just filling in some time for no reason.
Yeah, if it's fiddle, 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 like up the neck and down the neck and all that.
Look what I can do. Look.
Yeah, yeah. But then having said that, that's what we're all doing, isn't it, really? We're showing off a little bit. There would be no art without ego. That's what I said. There'd be no Sistine Chapel if it wasn't for Michelangelo having an ego. You know, he wanted to show the world what a wonderful painting he could do for the ceiling.
Exactly. And I suppose probably was being quite competitive with other artists to say he was better than someone else.
Yeah. I mean, one could say he's doing it for religious reasons as well, but he still needed to get paid.
Yeah.
And he needed to be the one chosen to do the job by the Pope.
Yeah, yeah. Have you felt that competition's ever driven you, or maybe competition with yourself or with others?
Oh, yeah. Constantly both.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't think I deliberately compete with myself and say, oh, this has got to be better than the last one or as good as the last one. I certainly have that abiding principle that it mustn't be worse than the last one. It must be up to standard.
Yeah.
It's more about the fact that, rather arrogantly, I'm going to say I presume a standard at my age now, and my efforts are directed towards having the effect I want to have with the song.
Mm.
You know, are the words right for it? Are they going to give the message across that I need to get across? Whether it's for a commercial film, which has got, you know, certain emotions that need to be put across, or whether it's for a record or whatever it's for. Is it doing its job? Will it have the effect? Will it have the emotional effect on people? I can sometimes find that if I'm sitting at the piano and I'm writing, and I usually write the lyrics when I'm at the piano, if I'm moved, even perhaps to tears occasionally, I know that that's a litmus test, that it means the audience probably will as well.
Yeah.
So I find that as a yardstick that, again, that's nothing to do with competing with oneself, but it's definitely what's in my mind when I'm writing. As regards competing with other people, the fact that there are so many successful songwriters in the world that are much better known than me and more successful than me is a matter of huge irritation. And, of course I'm competing with them.
I was hoping you were going to say something like that, but I was being really quiet. And just going, I wonder what Mike's going to say. How is he going to finish that sentence? And that's really pleased me.
I was listening to a Cat Stevens song in the, what was it, Peace Train, yesterday in the car. I thought, oh, my God, he was so good. But he was my age, a bit older, actually, I say proudly, as if it matters now. He was my model. He was my... Right. I want to be like Cat Stevens. He was like 3 or 4 years older than me. He was, you know, in his late teens when I was in my middle teens. And I thought, wow, that's what I want to do. I want to be a singer-songwriter. And he was just so brilliant. And I just listened to this track piece trainers, I said, and I thought, wow, that's great. And I wouldn't want to compete with him to the to the extent that I would do anything to blow that song out of the water or to destroy it. That's not the point of competition. No. You know, I was, if you like, the competition I felt was, I must be as good as that.
Hmm.
I think there's a level you get to where you think, I'm as good as him and I'm as good as her. I'd like to think I can be as good as those people, but I don't want to be any better.
Mm.
But I would fight anyone who said they were better than me.
And by better, do you mean better at the craft or do you mean better known?
Oh, no, better known is a slam dunk for most other people.
Right.
You know, most people are better known than me.
Mm-hmm.
But I say, you know, most of the great writers and artists, you know, the Paul McCartneys of this world are better known than me. There's no question.
Mm-hmm.
But I might occasionally say I'm as good as them.
Mm-hmm.
And I am.
Well, good. You should have that pride. We have to believe in ourselves.
It's a very fine line because you're sitting on the edge of being cocky and arrogant.
Mm-hmm.
And just a little bit step to the right or left, you've just got self-belief.
Yeah.
And where does self-belief become cockiness and arrogance? And sometimes I err on one side or the other.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question. I wonder if maybe the cocky and arrogant thing comes from like a panic state and maybe thinking that you're not delivering or maybe actually not delivering. Because I would think someone was cocky and arrogant if they said they're as good as Paul McCartney, but they hadn't really done much. That's definitely cocky and arrogant because that's just based on nothing, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I think maybe we shouldn't use Paul as a yardstick. I just meant people like, you know, people of that stature.
Yeah.
Paul Simon, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, am I better than Paul Simon? I'm asking myself now.
Yeah.
And I'll answer it right now here on this show for you. Yes, I am. I'm not better. I'm as good. I'm sometimes as good.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'm as good as Paul Simon. Sometimes he's not as good as me.
Right.
And I think there's a level you get to,
mm-hmm.
and it's nothing to do with how well known you are, where you can proudly say, I belong to that club.
Yeah.
You know, even if, you know, you haven't actually got a membership card.
How does that make you feel, knowing that you can be part of that club or knowing that you are?
Very good. I feel good. Sometimes it makes me a bit, why am I not therefore, you know, as well regarded by the people in the world? I tell you, one of the things is I haven't had much success in America. I think if you have a lot of success in America, it sort of trickles down to the rest of the world like a Christmas pudding, like the what do you call it, the sauce on a Christmas pudding,
brandy sauce.
Yeah,
yeah, I guess so. Oh, the brandy sauce metaphor, I know it well.
Yeah, my brandy sauce starts at the bottom and tries to get higher, and it doesn't work that way.
It's more like sort of sinking mud or something, like trying to suck you in.
Someone should invent creative anti-gravitational brandy sauce.
Yeah. Elon Musk is probably not too busy at the moment. You could ask him. Contentious character, perhaps. I love what you said about moving yourself with your music and that being important as far as taking a song forward, because I thought I was a real weirdo that I would like have tears pricking my eyes when I was writing a chord sequence. But that's how I do it too. So if I'm not moved by a song I'm writing, I'm probably not going to finish that song because I'm not that bothered about it. I suppose I don't really have the energy for it or the emotional reaction.
Mm.
Thank you for making me feel moderately less weird.
Yeah. Well, A, there's nothing wrong with feeling or being weird. But,
oh, no, I know.
In fact, it can be a big plus. but... No, I get what you mean.
Mm.
You could be wasting your time if you're writing a song you know isn't moving, isn't a moving song. Unless you don't want it to be a moving song, you might want it to be a jolly song. You know, a song like 9 to 5.
Yeah, I love that song.
Brilliant song, Dolly Parton song. And it's fantastic. But it's not going to make you burst into tears and ring your mum, you know, is it?
No, no. Yeah, they could definitely have different functions, don't they?
Yeah.
I've got more questions from people, the people of the world. Such a good one. This is such a good one. Have you ever heard a cover of one of your songs that made you feel like that artist actually wrote it?
There have been many of my songs that have been covered by other people where the world thinks they've written it.
Of course. And how does that feel?
Horrible. But, you know, you do rely on people identifying the artist with the song.
Yes, of course. And that's the job, isn't it? You know, that is the job, isn't it?
People do think Art Garfunkel, a lot of people think Art Garfunkel wrote Bright Eyes. Mm-hmm. And I'll be honest, I'm sure that he's not driven, just because he's a human being, to tell everybody at every concert that he didn't write that song.
Of course not.
You know, it's not entertaining. It doesn't help him.
No.
And sometimes, particularly if I'm in the audience and he knows I'm in the audience, he will tell everyone that I wrote it.
Well, that's decent of him at least.
Yeah. And the same with Katie. I mean, you know, people talk about, well, the worst ones are where you look on the, you've forgotten what the lyrics are. So you look on the web for the lyrics to 9 Million Bicycles and it goes, 9 Million Bicycles by Katie Melua. And you think, no, it wasn't.
No.
But what they mean is the song as performed by Katie Melua.
Yes. As presented by.
Yeah. And so it's not her fault.
No, of course not.
You know, it's just slightly irritating that they don't say.
Of course.
Written by. It's not just me, it's every writer.
Yeah.
You know.
That's interesting though, because you're right. People do need to, or they will naturally associate. The person who's singing the song must have written it, or they must have written the words at least.
Yeah. And I've had the opposite as well, where you've had a big artist record a song. It's usually when I haven't produced it. But again, I could be accused of arrogance by saying this. I haven't been in the room when they've done it. And that I once had John Denver cover a song of mine, which it's not a well-known hit. It's a song I wrote when my now 30-year-old son was born. It's called I Watch You Sleeping. And it's one of my favourite songs. And John Denver loved it. I never met him. Oh, I did meet him once on a breakfast TV show. In fact, after he'd recorded it, and I didn't criticise him for it. I was too gutless or too polite.
Another fine line.
He'd actually added extra beats into it, changed the chord slightly. He'd done so much to it that it showed he didn't understand the song at all.
Right.
And he recorded it. And, it's now reminded me that I bumped into him at breakfast television one time when we were both on. And he said, oh, Mike Batt, I recorded your song of I Watch You Sleeping. And I said, yeah, I heard it. Thank you for recording it. And I left it like that. I didn't say it was great. I didn't say it was good. I just said, thank you for recording it.
Yeah. Awkward.
Well, that's all right, isn't it? That's not lying. There's a great story where we all went to see this song, this show. Mm. I mustn't say what the show was.
Oh, no, no.
In fact, if I don't say what the show was and who it was with, it's not as funny. But I went to the show with several what you might call theatrical big names that were in the audience. It was an opening of a show. Mm-hmm. And Don Black was one of the people, the lyricist Don Black, who's a good friend of mine. And we both agreed, in fact, everyone in the audience agreed pretty much, on the way we were walking to the after-show party down a London street. Mm-hmm. And it was, what do we say? What are we going to say about this? He said, well, you've just got to say something about it that isn't whether it's good or not, you know.
Yeah.
And anyway, we arrived at the cafe, this big posh cafe, where the after-show party was, and I'm with Don, and the mother of the writer of the musical was greeting us at the door and said, so what did you think, Don? And he said, well, there wasn't any tap dancing in it, was there? and laughed, and she laughed. And it just diffused the situation to the point where she didn't really want to know what he thought of it anymore. And I just slipped past.
Can I steal that?
Yeah. The fact was, there wasn't any tap dancing in this one. The time you mustn't say that is when there is tap dancing in it.
Oh, so when you've pretended to watch someone's show, but you didn't, and you missed the fact that
no, not that one. That's also a killer. That's great. But no, what I'm saying is, if you come to, away from, you know, 42nd Street, and someone says, "What did you think of it?" and you say, "Well, there wasn't any tap dancing in it," it's sort of making out that they can't really tap dance very well, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose so. We have to be supportive of other people's creativity. That's the point. It can be such a hard thing to do. And it's, yeah. I just, you know, if I don't like something, I'll just move on, and I'll champion things that I love and pretty much ignore things I don't love. And I wish the world is a bit more like that. I know there's room for criticism and things, and I don't know, you can't just say everything's brilliant all the time. But as an individual, it's not for me to judge someone else's artistic output. It's nothing to do with me, you know.
No, I know critics who have gone to shows by people they like. Who have chosen not to review it rather than review it in the way they would have had to have reviewed it if they said that what they felt.
Oh. Okay.
And they've said, you know, I just didn't review it. Or they just didn't review it and they didn't say anything.
Yeah.
And I think that's a kind thing to do.
Yeah.
It's kind. It's better to say nothing. It's like your mum used to say, you know, can't say anything nice, don't say anything at all.
I think that's pretty great advice for the music world, to be honest, because it's, you know, it's such an individual thing, like the response to a piece of work, the creation of a piece of work. It's, you know, if you can find an audience for your work who love it, it doesn't really matter if someone thinks it's shit. It doesn't matter at all. It doesn't come into it then.
No, and also you have to understand that almost everything you write, in fact, everything you write, someone is going to think it's shit.
Yeah.
You know. And you have to get used to that. In fact, the most successful things of all are the bit things where 50% of the world think it's shit and 50% of the world think it's absolutely gold dust.
Yeah.
Because the 50% of people loving it is better than everyone thinking, well, it's okay.
Yeah.
Not okay enough to go out and buy. And not okay enough to buy, even to write a bad review. So it just disappears.
Yeah.
But if 50 out of 100 people go, I have got to have this, you know, and 50 go, well, I don't. I think it's terrible. you're onto a winner.
I read this brilliant thing a few weeks ago. I wish I could attribute it. I just can't remember. But someone was saying, you could be the best peach in the world, like the juiciest, fluffiest, whatever peaches are, peach, the best example of a peach there ever was.
The peachiest peach.
The peachiest peach of all peaches. But there's always going to be someone who hates peaches. They just hate them.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm keeping that in my mind a lot at the moment because I think it's so helpful when it comes to like creative output.
Yeah. Life's a peach and then you die.
Life's a peach and then you get eaten. Except by the people who don't like peaches. So it's good to have them around, actually. I'm going to pick another question by a person, a real person, unlike myself. Let's see. When was the last time a song stopped you dead in your tracks?
Whoa. I can't think. I'd have to think a long time about that. Because there have been such moments, and there are times when I think, wow. Do you know what? I'm going to have to pass on that one.
Okay.
I can't. Right. I thank the questioner for the question, but I'm afraid I'm going to abdicate the responsibility of an answer.
Do you have any memories of songs that have stopped you in your tracks? It doesn't have to be the last one, though. Have there been certain songs you just think, that is wonderful?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I heard Bridge Over Troubled Water before it came out in the corridor of Dick James Music in Oxford Street, and I just thought, whoa, this is going to take over the world. It is such a good song.
Yeah.
It just did. I mean, it's like a balm on someone's troubles. And it's beautifully performed. And that we're talking about way back in something like 1969, maybe. That was one. So there you were. There have been moments when that happened. A lot more of those moments when I was a young fan. You know, wow, I love this one and I love that one.
That's so interesting because you heard it away from the zeitgeist. So you heard it before it came out.
Mm.
I think there's a lot of people who love a song because obviously the repetition of it, you're hearing it on the radio all the time or it's on TV all the time, especially, you know, 20 years ago when it was, or longer, when it was, that's how you heard things. And it was the repetition of something, the familiarity you would get from hearing something all the time. But the fact that you heard that before all of that and you still knew it was going to be an important song, that's really interesting.
Yeah, because it had the power to just affect you. Another one I had that with, but it wasn't an emotional perception, was I also heard Space Oddity by David Bowie before it came out.
Wow.
And that was, everyone in the office went, what? That's incredible, you know.
Yeah.
Because it was at the time. I mean, looking back on it, it doesn't seem that. I mean, it's good, but it's not, you know, earth-shattering, really.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, you know, it's a little bit bubblegum in places, and but nothing, not there's anything wrong with bubblegum. Here speaks the writer of the Wombles.
Yeah.
But, you know. So that, yeah, I think hearing some, and the other thing I proudly remember now about hearing things before they came out, and it was usually when I just entered the music business, because I wouldn't have been in those hallowed halls, which seemed like very ordinary halls at the time, corridors, offices, was the Beatles White Album. I heard that. I was working as I was head of A&R for Liberty Records when I was 19, and an act called Hapshash and the Coloured Coat, who were an acid rock band, actually, and I joined them as their third member because they needed a musician in the band because they were actually painters. And they hung around in all the right places and they knew everyone, and they were part of the scene, the Chelsea scene, the swinging London scene. I wasn't. I was new to the job. But I was a musician and songwriter. So they added me to the band so that we could make this record. Anyway, during that time, they said, oh, we've got something to play. We often had lunch sometime. And they said, when we go back to your office, we want to play something. The cassette of the Beatles' new album, White Album. And it had been given to them by Patty Boyd, George Harrison's girlfriend, mm-hmm. and the night before, just on a cassette, you know, one of the old Compassion cassettes. So we took it into my office and we just sat there listening to it thinking, "Whoa, this is really serious," you know.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
Did it feel cool at the time? Did you know that it was a moment?
Yeah. It felt like we knew something that the world didn't yet know, but the world was going to know it big time.
Yeah.
They're Rocky Raccoon and things like that on it.
I love that record. That was big for me when I was a little kid. That was one of the first albums I got seriously into from my parents, yeah.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
Yeah. Anyway, there you go.
This might be a very difficult question, and feel free to tell me it's ridiculous, but what are you most proud of creating so far?
It is a ridiculous question.
Sorry. I know.
No.
I've got to try.
That's a cheap shot, my response there. I was teasing you. But I can't say, honestly, I really can't. There's a lot of stuff that the world doesn't know about, really, that I've done that I'm proud of, extremely proud of, like classical type overtures and things that I did for Watership Down. I did a whole series of Watership Down, a suite, an orchestral symphonic suite, and generally people don't know them. And, I'm very proud of them as actual classical pieces. They don't conform with the avant-garde, you know, coolness of avant-garde current, you know, cutting-edge, so-called cutting-edge writers. But they are symphonic pieces that I'm very proud of. But I wouldn't say they're the most thing, you know, proud thing I've ever done.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that they're amongst the things that I put my hand on my heart and say I'm really proud of that, you know.
Yeah. Maybe an easier question is there anything that you really hate now and wish you hadn't done and would delete from your back catalogue? And you don't have to name the things at all. I'm not trying to like shame your back catalogue or anything.
Yeah.
But I wonder if you feel any negativity towards parts of it.
Yeah. There's a couple of songs I've written in the past which I wish I hadn't written. Not, they weren't vicious or anything, but they're a bit twee maybe.
Okay.
When I was younger, I wrote a song to a particular female person using her name.
Okay.
But I really wish I hadn't done.
Yeah.
It was a love song, you know.
Is it like having a bad tattoo, do you think?
Yeah, exactly. Actually, yeah, the perfect description, the audio version of a bad tattoo.
You can have that for a lyric if you like. I know you don't collaborate. It said you can have that for a lyric if you want. I know you don't collaborate, so I wouldn't try and work on it with you. You can have it.
Thank you. And
as a gift.
Okay. Well, if you use it, I won't claim any research and development rights on it.
Of course. But I was in the room.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that has been a legitimate claim for people.
I know.
We often say, don't we, to... Well, certainly we do in the there's a thing called the Society of Distinguished Songwriters that I'm part of, which is shortened as SODS.
Right.
And
yes.
We often say, oh, yes, of course, he was in the room when he wrote that.
Mm.
And they're credited equally and they get 50% each.
Mm. How do you feel about that?
Well, it hasn't happened to me. Well, no, it hasn't.
Push everyone out of the room before you write it down.
No, because very often you have a songwriter team, in certainly the old-fashioned songwriting terms, teams, where one of them is the promotion man, really.
Right.
He's the one who gets the energy up. He's the one who says, let's write this song.
Yeah.
I'll go and sell it to the world. And the other one's the sort of orchestration, piano player guy who just does a lot of the work and doesn't act. And then maybe the other guy will add one or two words that just give it that little extra. And the argument would go, for that input, he deserves 50%. And, of course, now it's not just that. It's, yeah, but what about when you've got eight writers and one of them's only the guy that did the beats?
Mm.
I say only the guy that did the beats. Might be the beats that sell it.
Exactly.
It's where songs have stopped being songs, they've become productions, and it's not just all about the song. It's about, well, they always have been that, but there have been defined jobs. There have been, you know, somebody's the producer, somebody's the arranger, somebody's the lyricist, and somebody's the tunesmith.
Yes.
Somebody sings it, and there's a defined amount of money and credit for each person. It's no longer that now. It's a sort of street fight. I think there must be some method to it, but it's not a world that I'm immersed in. We live in a different world. We've all got different skills. So let me tell you what I've just said and reverse it completely and say what I'd say if I was on the other side of the house, which is, why shouldn't, if somebody's great at doing beats, then say, here are my beats for sale, guys. Here's my stall. Do you want to buy them or not? And someone says, yeah, I love that. That's going to make my song into a hit. Great. Well, in that case, I want 25% of the writing.
Yeah.
Why not?
Yeah.
You know, it's all legitimate. That's it. That's the problem with the world. There's always another point of view, isn't there? That's
there
usually
is.
Just as right as your point of view.
Yeah. It doesn't mean we can't have opinions, though. I mean, I would never want to have the songs that I present under my own name, you know, as an artist, as a recording artist, written in that form. I write all of my stuff myself. It would be very weird for me to have anyone involved in that. I do co-writes with other people. I try and collaborate with other people in different ways, but my own thing is my own thing.
Brilliant.
But I do think it's interesting the way they're doing it. In terms of co-writing, if I was in a room with seven other people, I would just be concerned that everyone was trying to be the loudest so that they could justify their place in that room and justify their percentage. Because if you're the quietest one, they might just be at lunchtime, well, you're not contributing, get out, because we're not sharing our money with you.
Yeah.
Before the song's even done. But of course, that's commercial writing. It's something I haven't done. So I don't know. It doesn't seem appealing in terms of, having a song written for me that way. I definitely wouldn't want that.
Yeah.
But in terms of being a writer, if that's the way they're doing it, and you know, you can justify your place in that room, I don't know. It's maybe it's just how it's done.
If you equate it to a room full of comedy writers, say,
there's
six writers and they're all chucking gags in, and they're not expecting they're not going to get a percentage. They're getting paid by the page or the day or whatever fee that they've got negotiated.
Yeah,
it's the same thing. It's just as creative to be part of a writing team in that sense.
Yes.
So why are we, being so harsh about it in music? But I suppose again, the other side of the argument could also get split into, well, Elton only wrote the tunes. Bernie wrote the words. So whose songs are they? You know, well, I'm not saying they aren't Elton's.
No.
Because they are both. They are written by, just as Rodgers and Hammerstein wrote.
Yeah.
And, you know, the great partnerships.
Yeah. That's like where the sum is bigger than, what's it called? The result is bigger than sum of its parts. Is that the way
you're
saying?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
So, you know, like the Beatles, for instance.
Yeah.
Created something that only those four people could have made.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's very interesting.
Yeah.
Are you up for talking about the internet a little bit, in brief?
Yeah, of course.
You obviously have had a very varied and busy career before the internet came along. And I'm just interested to know if you see it as a generally positive thing for you or how it's impacted your career.
Well, it's led to streaming. If you jump from the beginning of the internet to now, the result is streaming, which, as you know, we're right in the middle of an argument at the moment. I'm not an active player in that argument. I would have been 5 years ago because I was deputy chairman of the British phonographic industry. So I had a role to play, which would have been to defend the labels, and I would have been uncomfortable in that role.
Right.
Although there are some very good points that the labels have, which is that they spend money marketing, they risk a lot of money on artists that don't make it, all that sort of thing. There are points for both sides. That's my problem. I could never be a barrister because I'd have to just be on one person's side, and I can see everyone's point of view. That's my problem.
So,
streaming has pretty much decimated the industry and made, at least currently, it very difficult for artists, of your age, to make a living from selling recordings.
Yeah.
Whereas when I came into it, you either got kicked out the door of the record company and never got any further and got a job as a cab driver or as a nuclear scientist, whatever it was you're going to be.
Yeah.
But now there's such little, the payments are so small that you have to do something else, like be a nuclear scientist or a taxi driver or make cakes, whatever it is you're going to do, to be allowed to do what is now seen almost as a hobby, unless suddenly you jump the fence and, wow, you know, you take off. And usually it takes a record company to make you do that. So things are almost the same as they were before. The record companies reach down into the masses and pick out one lucky person. And I'm not saying they're only lucky. They're probably very talented as well. And that becomes the new Jake Bug or the new whoever it was before that.
Yeah,
I say the new Jake Bug because I know he's been around for years, but, you know, he was one of many people that year, but he was the one that got picked out and made into a star that year. Okay, so the beginning of the internet, what it's done is it's taken away that thing where the record company says, no, you can't make a record. You haven't done enough gigs. We haven't heard of you enough. Your manager's not good enough yet. We don't know your manager well enough, and we're not going to spend money on you. So you, again, as I say, you just walk sadly home and put the telly on. Now, you stay at home, you don't even leave the door, you make your record and you put it out. You don't even have to leave your front door. And it's out there. The net result being that billions of people have got records out. No one notices yours.
Might cry in a minute because that's exactly what I'm doing. I made it in this room that you can see behind me and I didn't leave my house to do it.
Yeah, and I make records in this room that you can see behind me.
Yeah, yeah.
We're competing against, I call it white noise.
Yeah.
There's so much of it. It's like...
Yeah.
And or background radiation. You know, it's just... It's just so many people that are in there. And as I say, it's only the ones who have got backing, i.e. money behind them, who usually, and I say usually because, of course, there are those who have things that go viral or, you know, they're clever and they get through another way.
Mm-hmm.
But generally speaking, the major record companies are back on top.
Yeah.
Because they're the ones that can reach into that white noise and pick out the lucky winner, the raffle ticket holder, and make them into the star of that year. Give them the Mercury Prize, then go on to get a Brit, and they're off, you know.
And all of this was changing pretty rapidly as Katie Melua's career was starting, wasn't it? Is that the right time, like iTunes coming along?
It was starting then, but there was still, most records are sold on CD,
mm-hmm.
and it was possible for me to, when I took the massive risk of turning down the record company that wanted her because they didn't want us to record the songs that we wanted to record. And I say we, meaning her and me, not just me.
Yeah.
She turned down, she as a young girl from Georgia who had never seen the price of, you know, a good car ever.
Mm-hmm.
She was turning down a six-figure sum. I said, it's your decision. One of the major record companies offered us, well, I'll tell you, £500,000 to make an album.
Yeah.
And she very bravely said, no, what else can we do? How can we get out of this? And I said, well, we could do it at my studio. I pay for it. And we'll put it out on my label.
Mm-hmm.
I can't guarantee it'll be successful. I can guarantee it'll be just as good a record. But so she said, well, let's do that then. And so that's how we did it. It was, I know you asked a different question. I've probably...
No, that's fine. This is way more interesting than my question, because that's a brave thing to do. What year was that?
About 2002.
Because not completely unheard of then for people to put out their own music, but it was a lot harder than it is now, because the means of getting stuff out was still very... There was a system that you had to slot into.
Yeah.
So that must have been challenging in some ways.
It wasn't the first independent label, but it was certainly the most outrageous. Not outrageous is wrong, because it's not outrageous to succeed or to try. It was the most... what is it they call it when something's a bit cheeky and a bit sort of impudent? It was impudent of us to try and not beat the system, compete with the system on the level we did.
Mm.
And the fact that we did it with such success, I mean, you know, we sold 1.8 million of the first album.
Mm.
And even when we'd only sold 200,000, she was obviously going somewhere. The major record companies were saying to us, oh, you'll never get any further than that without us. You need us to press up the bulk. You never get past a million.
Yeah.
And we just showed them to be wrong, because we'd already done all the hard work and broken her. I had to spend quite a lot of money TV advertising, which was and is still very much not what you do. You don't the rule is you don't TV advertise something that isn't a well-known product.
Mm.
So you're all right TV advertising Eric Clapton's greatest hits.
Yeah.
But you're not all right doing Fred blogs that you've never heard of,
mm-hmm.
or Frida blogs.
Sense. Yeah.
And we broke that rule, and we advertised heavily on television. The only time I ever say, when people say, oh, Katie was lucky, I argue like mad to say she wasn't. She was steely. She made that decision. She helped me make that decision that we won't go with the big record company, because if we would have died the death, they would have definitely not held on like we did.
Mm-hmm.
But the only thing I'll say where she was lucky is that I, and I will take credit for this, did something that no record label, and even the record labels were competing with us, said to me afterwards, we would never have done that.
Mm.
They would never have spent hundreds of thousands of pounds on television, particularly if they'd known as well how much of a risk it was, because even though I was supposed to be successful and famous and everything, my finances were in a pickle.
Right.
And so putting down 100,000 quid to start with, and then following it with 50,000 more and 50,000 more and so
on. Terrifying. That's terrifying.
It was like diving off a diving board and not quite knowing how deep the water was.
How did that feel? How was the stress level in your house at that time?
It was exhilarating.
Okay.
Actually, because yeah. It was scary as hell. Mm. My independent distributors took me to lunch when we went in at number 40.
I bet they did.
And they said, just to prepare you for the fact that you're going to go down 20 places next week. I said, well, what? How come? I thought you go in at 40 and that's 20. No. All the Christmas records are going to come out next month, for next week. And you're going to be, at least 20 of them are going to sell more than you're going to sell. And sure enough, that happened. We went down to 60.
Mm.
And I thought, well, I've got to spend more money then. So I borrowed some more money against the house, you know.
Right.
And I just started shoveling money at it. And there was one point where I thought, without actually her getting on television so that people can see her perform, because she was a wonderful live performer, we're not going to get anywhere with this. I've got to stop and then breathe and then start again in January.
Mm.
And I just made the decision, no, I'm going to have another week push at it. When the phone went and the director of the Royal Variety show, who had previously said no to her, is a friend of mine, actually, I thought he was ringing to apologise for having turned her down.
Yeah.
I said, I know you've turned her down, Jeff, and it won't affect our relationship. And he said, no, I'm ringing to tell you the bad news. Because he said, he teased me. He said, I'm ringing you up to give you bad news. I said, I've got the bad news already, Jeff. Stop wasting my time. You know, you're forgiven, you know. Get over it. And he said, no, the bad news is you've got to buy her a new frock and a plane ticket to Edinburgh. She's on somebody's dropped out and she's going to be on the Royal Variety. So that
amazing
was 10 minutes after I'd agreed in my own mind to spend the extra money that week. And yeah. The two things together were what catapulted her to number one.
That's incredible.
So to answer your question, it was scary. It was horrible. It was up and down, but it was joyous and it was fabulous. Yeah. You know, I wouldn't have had it any other way.
Yeah, that's a really exciting story. Because I know from people I've spoken to for this series and just generally, and you know, having made music for so long, it's money and the machine that helps you hear of someone. That's how someone generally becomes a household name. Certainly, you know, in the old days of that system being the only system.
Mm.
And you're right, of course, things can go viral, you know, but there's always a story behind that. There's this brilliant book called, I think it's called Hitmakers, that I just read recently. And that's all about the story behind viral sensations, because there's always something more going on. That people have built up their own communities already, or there's something, you know, or it's coming out of a scene or something like that. It's never really just, oh, this thing just went viral and that's it. Oh, that could happen to me, so I'll just keep hoping, because that's not really how life works.
Keep filming your cat.
Exactly. Yeah. Maybe it'll talk one day.
Exactly.
But the one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you, one is because somehow we've been following each other on Twitter for years and I'm not sure how. And so it's just really lovely. I love that every now and again I think, oh, Mike Batts just popped up on my feed and he follows me as well for some reason. But also because I think your career so far, you know, as it has been and as it continues, shows that it's turning up and doing more work and doing more and more is what creates that. You never sat around crossing your fingers hoping for someone to pick you. And you never sat around crossing your fingers hoping for someone to pick Katie.
No.
You actually did stuff. And that is what I respect so much. So it's been wonderful to talk to you.
Oh.
I really, really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. It's nice of you to say those things. Well, I hope it's been interesting. And I've certainly enjoyed the chat.
Good.
So thanks for thinking of me. And
of course.
Hope it goes well.
And I know that you wrote Bright Eyes. So anytime you're like, damn that guy, I know.
Yeah, if you go to an Art Garfunkel concert and he doesn't say, Mike Batt wrote this, you can shout out from the stalls.
I, for one, am thoroughly inspired by that conversation. Please do check out Mike's work at mikebatt.com. And as always, I've made a deluxe show notes page on my website at penfriend.rocks/Mike, where you can also pick up 2 free Penfriend songs. If you're enjoying Attention Engineer, please do me a kind favour and share it with a friend leave a rating or a review, and of course, click subscribe so that you can hear next week's conversation. This is a completely independent podcast which relies on word of mouth to keep reaching people, so any help with that is greatly appreciated by me. My work is made possible by the Correspondence Club, a friendly group of generous patrons of the arts. Thanks so much to every member. If you're interested in browsing the free and paid tiers, just visit penfriend.rocks/join to find out more. And if you're enjoying the music in the background, I have a new single and video out now, and an album pre-order launching later this week. So, yeah, it's a really good time to head to my website and get involved. Thanks again for listening. I'll be back next Wednesday with another deep conversation about creativity, grit, and determination. So I hope to catch you then. Take care. Keep a kiss for me, 'cause we all fall down under.